Olive leaf extract is an extraordinary source of the beneficial polyphenols found in olive oil and in olive plants. And now you can get all the benefits from a supplement, olive leaf extract, available through drhoffman.com. Olive leaf extract, one of my favorite supplements. Welcome to the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and we're coming to a podcast that I've long anticipated because it covers a subject that is relatively new and fascinating, and we haven't discussed it yet on the Intelligent Medicine Podcast in great depth. So we're going to devote the next 45 minutes or 50 minutes or so to a complete discussion of something called MTHFR. Now, this is a family show, so I don't mean to utter an extreme profanity, but MTHFR, a set of initials that stands for something that we're going to share with you in just a few moments, is revolutionizing our approach to a wide variety of disparate and baffling disorders. It's the key to many health problems, but it's not simple, and we're going to talk to an outstanding expert who has made it his business to really understand in great depth the implications of MTHFR. He is Dr. Ben Lynch, and Dr. Lynch is located in Portland, Oregon, and he has a background that he graduated from the University of Washington with a Bachelor's of Science in Cell and Molecular Biology, which is fortunate because this stuff involves a lot of complex chemistry and biology. He was pre-med, but decided to go to naturopathic school. He began Bastyr University, which is the country's foremost naturopathic medical school, in 2002. And subsequently, he's embarked on a project to educate people about many facets of health. So without further ado, here's Dr. Ben Lynch. It's a pleasure having you on the program, Dr. Lynch.
Yep. Thank you, Dr. Hoffman, for having me.
Did I get it right about your background? Pretty much covered the correct biographical information?
Yeah.
So what was it that got you on this path? You have your own personal health saga, and it sounds like you overcame various obstacles to your health.
The personal obstacles I overcame, you know, back in, I would say, in my medical school days, I could not tolerate sauna at all. I'd be in there for about 30 seconds, and I'd get sick, and the rest of my classmates would be doing just fine. I would have foot drop, and I'd be walking in the hall, and my right foot would just kind of, on its own, just drop. It scared the heck out of me. So needless to say, those two conditions there were kind of nerve-wracking, and then I would also I was very sensitive to chemicals, and I guess my history of growing up on a horse ranch and having crop dusters by around my house and spraying Roundup all the time didn't help. So I think that increased my desire to learn more about naturopathic medicine and environmental medicine as well. And then I got super sick in India prior to all this, which is how I found out about naturopathic medicine.
And your bodily configurations have changed with the current dietary regimen that you're on. You once weighed over 200 pounds, I see from your bio.
Yeah, that I was about 213 pounds, but that was when I was an athlete at University of Washington. And I would have to say that the configuration of my body is gone maybe for the worse. I was 213 pounds then of basically pure muscle.
Solid muscle. You were like a tall guy, so that you accommodated that.
I used to row for the Huskies, and then I traveled in over a year overseas in Southeast Asia and South Pacific, and I got very ill in India, and I came back at 160 pounds.
Goodness, okay.
Yeah, so I was pretty bad.
Yeah. So 160 pounds is a good weight for me at about 5'10 and a half, but not for you. You're well over 6 feet.
Yeah.
So anyway, so let's get to the subject at hand because you have become an authority on the subject of MTHFR polymorphism. So describe that for our listeners who are not yet acquainted with it.
Yeah, so MTHFR is basically an acronym which I found while researching something in the National Institutes of Health research database, you know, PubMed. I was researching a bipolar, and this thing came up, and I was like, what the heck is that? And then so I plugged it back into PubMed, and I realized that it was a gene that was related to a whole bunch of different serious conditions, such as blood clots, cancer, bipolar, schizophrenia, preeclampsia, recurrent miscarriage, and so on. And I started looking into this, and then basically I typed in MTHFR gene, and what it is, it's a gene, it stands for methyl tetrahydrofolate reductase, and what it does is it takes one form of folate and it converts it to the body's most active form of folate. So we all know about folic acid, but what we don't know about folic acid is it takes about five genes to convert that really insignificant, ineffective nutrient of folic acid in order to be converted into methylfolate. And MTHFR is the very last gene to do that. So that, I realized, is a big problem because methylfolate pretty much does everything. Folic acid doesn't do anything. So I realized it was no wonder it was so broadly visible in numerous pathologies.
Well, okay, that leads us to a little bit of a segue. A lot of people think that they're getting the real deal when they get a multivitamin or a B-complex or a B12 folic acid combo. These are real popular on the supplement market. But what you're saying is that without the body's ability to convert this pre-folate into active, metabolizable, utilizable folate, that is worthless. So explain that.
Yeah, I think we need to step back a little bit and define folate, because a lot of people equate folate to folic acid.
Right, one and the same thing.
Yeah, and folate is a broad umbrella term. So there's numerous types of folate, and the three biologically relevant forms of folate are folinic acid and methylfolate. And folic acid is man-made, and so the body has to convert it into folinic acid and then into methylfolate. So that is one aspect that has to happen in the body. Now, our supplements and many of our enriched foods, as we proudly purchased and proudly claimed on the cereal boxes and on the supplement bottles, use folic acid. And now, yes, granted, they have reduced neural tube defects by about 25% to 30% and overall in the population, but we have to understand that folic acid does not do anything unless it goes through these different genes. And the general public worldwide have a high prevalence of MTHFR gene mutation, which reduces the ability to convert this folic acid into usable forms of folate for the body, which really restrict our biochemistry.
So what percentage of the population might be thus affected? Or another way of looking at it is, who has perfect metabolism and can just take folic acid from a multivitamin and perfectly convert it without any impediments?
Nobody.
Okay. That's a pretty broad statement.
Yeah. Yeah. It's nobody, because there's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 genes, 7 that I can count, 8 right off the top of my head that require to be working absolutely perfectly in order for folic acid to be utilized by the body.
So that's kind of like like getting perfect brackets in the in the March Madness competition.
Yeah,
is
exactly.
To get it all right, get each and every one perfect.
That's right. And I think Obama got it right.
Right. Well, no.
Oh, okay.
Otherwise, he would have gotten that $1 billion from Warren Buffett, but he didn't. He probably got it maybe under the table, but not because he won the brackets competition.
Yeah, that's a good segue, but we'll keep it on target here.
Yeah.
So I would say nobody has it, and it is useful. I mean, folic acid is useful. It does do things, but it's also very harmful at the same time. So I'm of the belief that if people are eating their uncooked leafy greens or taking supplements with folinic acid and or methylfolate, that's going to be far superior than taking folic acid.
Okay. So what you're saying is that food-sourced folate, and by the way, as you're well aware, the word folate is related to the word foliage or defoliation or exfoliate, because foliage, our greens, are a great source of folate, which is the active form that our bodies use, correct?
Right. And if you look at, you know, you were asking who's most susceptible to this. And, you know, I'll give a concrete answer to that that's a little bit more focused to make it clinically relevant for people is the Italians, the Chinese, the Mexicans have a very high rate of MTHFR defects. So they're very genetically susceptible to folic acid not working very well for them at all. So upwards of, you know, 50% of them, one in two of them, have a pretty significant issue with that.
Okay, so where would you suspect such a thing? You know, you're a clinician, you see patients presumably. When do you suspect that an MTHFR glitch could play a role in your patient's condition? Is it virtually, you know, so universal that, you know, you always check for that? Or is there certain conditions where you go, this is really suspicious?
Well, autism is one that comes to mind. And that would be a big one. Cardiovascular disease is another. Mental dysfunction, such as, you know, depression or anxiety, is another. Chemical sensitivities, fibromyalgia, chronic fatigue, any type of syndrome. I would be looking into it.
And you yourself, with your chemical sensitivity, did you find that you had some of these polymorphisms on testing?
Yes.
And then you were, some of these susceptibilities were attenuated when you took the right kind of supplements?
That's correct. And it, you know, it's not a fast fix. So some people get literally an immediate relief if they take some methylfolate or methylcobalamin and they feel fantastic. Others will feel worse. Others will feel nothing. With me, I felt better quite quickly with it, but it wasn't, that was years after I already did a bunch of environmental medicine and sauna and heavy metal chelation and everything else. So it can take years of accumulation to get some significant symptoms, especially if you're a man, right? I mean, men don't want to go see the doctor until their one leg is gone.
Exactly. It's like they come into the doctor's office holding their head in their hands. They're going, I think there might be a problem here. I mean,
right.
I was, you know, until my head fell completely off, I wasn't going to do anything about it. But, you know, since it's off, I thought I'd see you.
That's right. Exactly. And now women are going in for pregnancy screening and what have you. And they might get lucky. Actually, I shouldn't say get lucky. A lot of women have successful pregnancies. But those who have the unfortunate experience of recurrent miscarriages or infertility or preeclampsia,
they might get tested. That is part of routine testing and specialized fertility workups.
That's right. It is. But the problem is the standard recommendation is 4 milligrams of folic acid.
Yeah.
And what ends up happening is they might get these 4 milligrams of folic acid and carry to term. But the problem is, what happens to baby as soon as that baby is born? They're forgotten.
Because it's an inherited defect.
They've passed on the MTHFR defect, most likely. They've passed on other inferior genes. Now they are susceptible to vaccinations and heavy metals and pesticides and herbicides and GMO foods and so on, and chlorine in our waters and formaldehyde in the new carpets and the solvents and the paints. And, you know, we buy all the new cribs and carpets for our baby rooms, and we wonder why they get super sick and autism. Well, we're getting inferior genetics in the population because we're forcing these pregnancies to term, and then we're forgetting that these babies actually need as much support as the mother had. So it's a big problem.
Well, now, there's an issue. Folic acid, as you know, is controversial in the nutritional literature. There are many times where in nutrition journals there's a debate over whether food should be fortified with folic acid, because it seems to be a two-edged sword. It is thought that, on the one hand, folic acid prevents neural tube defects. That's acknowledged, and it's actually been a pretty successful campaign. We've, you know, part of the March of Dimes, reduce birth defects, and it has worked. But there's some people who are concerned that folic acid has a pro-carcinogenic effect, that it may actually increase the risk of certain cancers. Some studies say no, some studies say yeah, but this is a controversy that keeps being batted around. Does this relate to the form of the folic acid, how it's delivered? Are there any harmful or deleterious effects if you have unutilized folic acid in your system because it's not passing through your pathways properly?
Yeah, great question. And there's a whole bunch of questions to be answered in that last statement. So first I'll answer the immediate one. If there are harmful issues with folic acid. One is folic acid, you absorb it. Folic acid by itself is very well absorbed compared to other types of folate. It's very well absorbed. And so that sounds great. But what happens is that folic acid, in order to get into the cell, it has to bind to a folate transport protein. And then that delivers it to a receptor. And that receptor then binds the folic acid. And then you would think that that's good, but it's not. Because with those folate binding proteins and those folate receptors, they're supposed to bind folinic acid and methylfolate.
So it's like putting the wrong key into the lock, sort of.
That's right. And breaking the key off.
Yeah.
So what happens then is these breastfeeding women are taking a whole bunch of folic acid, and you have a high amount of folate binding proteins in breast milk, naturally, because the baby needs a bunch of folate as they're growing and brain development and everything else. The problem is this folic acid, it binds these folate binding proteins, and it reduces their number. It downregulates them. It's just like sugar in diabetes. Downregulates the receptors.
So like insulin resistance in this case, or like folate resistance.
Exactly. And then we look at, then you compound the problem because you can't get folate into the cell. And most doctors just run a serum folate on patients. And if they see it normal to high,
It's always high. Virtually, in my experience, it's always high, except in some people who are on extremely weird diets, you know, not eating any vegetables occasionally, we'll see that.
Right. And that's just a big mosh pit of all the different types of folate. It doesn't tell you anything. It doesn't tell you what type of folate it is. It doesn't tell you what type of how much of folate is in the cell. And then, you know, RBC folate is an improvement, but it's still not good enough because you don't know what type of folate is in the cell. So you have to delineate, define what type of folate is in the cell, and then you need to look at the B12, because if B12 is low, the folate isn't able to do its job if there's B12 deficiency, and there's rampant B12 deficiency, right?
So, well, it's about this time that I wish, you know, going back to college, I was a humanities major and liberal arts, and I majored in anthropology and foreign languages. And I wish that I had been as diligent as you toting home my biochemistry and chemistry books so that I'd have a better understanding of all these complex pathways that you seem to be able to navigate your way through. It is very complicated, isn't it?
It is, and it's a big puzzle, and I've always loved puzzles, and I fell in love with biochemistry when I was 17 years old when I took biochem at my school. My high school featured it, when I was fortunate for that experience, and I had a great teacher, so I thank Dr. Lebo for that. But yeah, it's complicated, but the beautiful thing is, it's like when you stare at an x-ray, you know, when you were studying radiology, you get this complicated x-ray in front of you, and you look at all that, and you see a bunch of white and black and some spots. Like, what the hell? Where am I? But they teach you to start in the upper left corner and to navigate across and back and forth and then up and down, right? And so you look at a complicated picture, but you start in one area. And so that's how this whole biochemistry thing started. I started with this whole methylation thing with the gene MTHFR. I didn't know much about methylation at all. We didn't study it in med school. I mean, we studied it, but it wasn't called methylation. And that was 2007 I graduated, so it wasn't that long ago.
Right. And I have to tell you that this is absolutely not on the map during the time that I was in med school, which was considerably before you in the 1980s.
It still isn't.
It isn't. Right. It would not be taught. It would not be taught.
Yeah, still not. Still not. But it's making some big gains, and the doctors who are trying to wrap their head around this are seeing some significant improvements in their patients. And not only that, but they're able to navigate these medical conundrum, these difficult cases, more effectively, because they can start taking these weird things like elevated serum folate and serum B12 and say, aha, I know what to do with that. And they order additional tests and they can spot the problems and they start working with the patients and getting them better step by step. And so it's a very cool technique to improve these patients. And I think it's really putting standard medical processes and procedures and protocols face down. Because it's changing the way medicine is practiced.
Well, as you mentioned, your journey began when you looked up bipolar disorder, which is thought to be purely a psychiatric disorder, disordered brain chemistry, and yet you found links to MTHFR polymorphisms there. Is it possible that some people, a certain percentage of the people who are afflicted with the disorders that we treat with psych meds, might benefit from the right kind of unraveling of their pathways and nutritional support?
Oh, I would venture to guess 90% of them.
Wow.
I mean, if I could walk into a psych ward or any type of mental institute or addiction disorders institute and work with these people, I bet the majority of them would walk out normal. The issue is maintenance. The body is dynamic. You have to not only restore their biochemistry, but you have to teach them how to maintain. And people are genetically susceptible to these things, yes, but the environment controls the genes. I mean, epigenetics is huge right now. So we used to blame everything on our genetics. You know, I got bad genes from my mom, my dad, and so right. on. You know, balding, you know, we're screwed with that. I mean, we can't reverse that with, you can slow it down with healthy environment and good food and so on and reduce stress. But, you're still going to bald.
Mm-hmm.
And we're still going to die, unfortunately. But we can really optimize our neurotransmission as much as possible. And I just did a webinar yesterday that was streamed in Australia focused on mental illness. And I talked about methylation and MTHFR and a whole bunch of other things for a group of doctors down there. And it blew their mind. They had no idea.
Well, that's very exciting. And this is a logical inflection point for us to pause, because with the prospect that we can treat, according to our guest, Dr. Ben Lynch, virtually 90% of mental disorders with a proper understanding of biochemistry. This is part one of our podcast on the subject of MTHFR polymorphisms. And in just a moment, we'll resume with part two, and we'll focus on other areas of concern. What are the nutrients that help to reverse this? What are the tests that are required? What bearing does this have on the homocysteine connection and cardiovascular disease? Those are some questions we're going to take up in part two of our discussion with today's guest, Dr. Ben Lynch. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is Intelligent Medicine.